something was afoot, and they were terrified of the possibilities. So, but I think this talk about the Green Bay sweep just shows the high level of planning that was going on here. And let's not forget, it's a felony to disrupt the operations of Congress, and I think that's something that the January 6th committee is really honing in on. Was there a criminal conspiracy to disrupt Congress from doing its job on January 6th? And if so, who was involved in that? You know, obviously, Trump advisors were involved. You know, was the president himself involved? You know, to again, for the umpteenth time, get back to Watergate. You know, what did the president know, and when did he know it? I mean, I think there's going to be some real drama behind these hearings when they go public. They may be in prime time. I'm hearing now, which would be quite a political event in 2022.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Will Bunch, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, national columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll link to his pieces at democracynow.org. A very happy birthday to Clara Ibarra, and a belated happy birthday to Dennis McCormick. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tommy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlin, our general manager, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Romold.
Center cannot hold. This is somebody else's dream. Out of the nighttime, lifelines glow in the dark. Order falls apart. Nothing is as it seems, and all of the like minds who reel from this blow to the heart turn to each other on the night of the supermoon. There was nowhere left to run. To do or die. Time for grieving, time for saying goodbye. Time for leaving the lands of the beautiful light. As we gaze into the future on the night of the supermoon.
And good morning, everybody. This is your host, Paul Roland. Sorry I missed you last week. If you were listening, if you tuned in, between some vacations and the inclement weather, some people live in further outside of Portland having some trouble with the ice and such. We weren't able to get a board operator for my show, and so I wasn't able to come in because board operating and hosting at the same time is a difficult proposition. But anyway, that's probably too much information. But Ty is back this morning. Hey, Ty. And we are ready to roll. So that was Eliza Gilkison to set a somber, if somewhat apocalyptic tone there with her Lifelines song from Secularia from a few years back. You know, if you've never checked out Eliza Gilkison, I would recommend it. She's, in my opinion, one of the more thoughtful, insightful songwriters of our times. So there. So, I was going to talk about Don't Look Up last week, and didn't get a chance to, so I was thinking of doing that this week. Of course, everybody knows tomorrow is January 6th, so probably a lot of people want to talk about that. I guess if you do, I can't stop you. If you call up 503-231-8187, I'm all by my lonesome here in the studio. I know that Joe and Tracy talked about it on their show yesterday. I figured a lot of people would be talking about that subject. It was another reason why I thought I might focus on the movie Don't Look Up. Jacqueline Keeler, my regular second Wednesday co-host. I actually haven't checked with her. I think she's probably not going to be doing that for a while because she's starting her own program. I'm not sure if it's a temporary thing or a possible long-term thing, but it's going to be tomorrow at 10 a.m. And she'll be talking about her take from an Indigenous perspective, from her Indigenous perspective, on January 6th, which you've heard a lot about. Be probably somewhat familiar, but she'll be able to go into probably in some greater depth, kind of based on her book, Standoff, comparing the Bundy takeover of Malheur Wildlife Refuge with the occupation people's uprising, indigenous-led movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline of, was that 2015, 2016? I don't know. Time, it's hard to keep track of these days. But anyway, so definitely check that out. Jacqueline Keeler. Going solo here on KBOO at 10 a.m. tomorrow. There's a lot to talk about. There's a lot of apocalyptic strains in our collective life these days. But yeah, so I really did want to talk about this film. You know, I've talked a lot about the climate disaster over the years I've been doing this show. And this film really, it hit me hard, and I had some really immediate gut reactions to it. And to the extent that I kind of resented people sort of taking, you know, there's just so many voices, so many establishment critics who are like nitpicking. It was just, it was just details of the film. It was, you know, overdone. It was this, it was that. And just to me, just not getting the point that, you know, they were talking about, you know, it was a thinly veiled comet in the film. If you haven't seen it, this is a spoiler alert, as is said. Going to talk about the film. If you haven't seen it and you don't want, you know, to spoil your full enjoyment, you might want to tune out during this conversation. But, you know, I'm sure a lot of you have seen it. And it deserves talking about. So on we plunge. So yeah, I had these gut reactions that I resented kind of the standard critics, you know, and I thought a lot of the criticisms were even off base personally. I mean, I won't go into, you know, about the acting, about, you know, whether it was, you know, histrionic, hysterical, whatever, the tone of the film, all that sort of thing. And then, you know, I started seeing a lot of threads on Facebook talking about the film. And, you know, just approaching it from a critic, you know, a critique of the film, which is legit, but I didn't, because I saw it as reality. To tell you the truth, I saw it as reality. Because, you know, anybody who's been listening to my show over the years knows that, you know, I basically, you know, the climate is like a comet, and it's coming a little way faster than almost any of us are really prepared to admit, either publicly or to ourselves. And so, yeah, it's a perfectly good metaphor. The comet in the film, which a graduate student, PhD candidate at the University of Michigan, I believe, discovers totally by chance. You know, she's late at night. Jennifer Lawrence plays a wonderful role in this film. And, you know, is there kind of bored late at night, pushing the controls of this huge telescope, which is surveying. It's some sort of I think they're surveying for planets, distant planets. Anyway, and she sees something that catches her eye, and then she's like, oh my God, I've discovered a new comet. So she calls in her professor and some of the other PhD candidates, and they talk about it. And Leonardo DiCaprio actor, who plays the professor, starts to go down the calculations to see, you know, the trajectory and the where it's headed, all that, and he goes down the tables. Yes, you know, he's hasn't done this for a while, since his graduate school days or something. It's pretty well played. A lot of scientists like this film. Seems like most climate scientists really like this film. But anyway, so he gets down to the end of this very elaborate formula, and starts to realize that the trajectory is not a good one for planet Earth. In fact, it's on a direct collision course, and within six months and a few days, and that sets into motion this whole series of events in the film. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, 6 months, is that totally outrageous? Is that, in terms of the metaphor itself, you know, the comet being a metaphor for climate change, which there's no mystery about anymore. DiCaprio has talked publicly about it. You know, it's obvious in the film. There's a lot of subtle images in the film that refer to climate change. You know, there's the obligatory polar bears. There's, I don't know, I don't have the kind of head for details to be able to throw a lot of them out. But yeah, it's obvious in the film. So is it outlandish? You know, the most extreme, the most, I don't know, they don't consider it extreme. There's certain climate scientists, certain people who studied the science and are writing and blogging about it, talking about it. Some, you know, non-climate scientists who've really done a deep dive into the climate science and think they've got it, you know. Guy McPherson is probably the most known example in some circles of someone who basically says that, yeah, we don't know how much time we have. We might not have hardly any time, you know, before, you know, as the Arctic, you know, we can see the last decade, the heating up of the Arctic has really been driving a lot of the, you know, it seems like that's what drove the incredible heat wave in the Northwest this past summer. It drives these polar vortex events. You know, probably had something to do with the crazy situation in Virginia just a few days ago. There's just unbelievable gridlock. I mean, you know, more and more things are seeming like the apocalypse is upon us. That just mind-boggling fire that happened outside of Boulder. Anyway, and so, yeah, there's people who've been saying that these what's happened in the Arctic especially, it's not the only thing, but the, you know, the loss of the sea ice, the Arctic sea ice, the loss of the albedo effect, which is the diminishment of the albedo effect, which is the reflectivity of the ice, the white ice, which then you lose that and the heat increases. Then you start getting, the melting of the permafrost, more release of methane, release of other methane from other sources. It's just increase in forest fires, the diminishing of the capability of forests to absorb carbon dioxide. Some of them are becoming net emitters of carbon dioxide. Yeah, it's just a whole complex of interlocking feedback loops that, according to some, could set up a really apocalyptic massive release of methane, just a more rapid tripping of these tipping points. Anyway, so the metaphor itself is not that outlandish. The timeline, as I say, according to some people, and this is hard for people to hear, it's hard for me to think about, might seem easy me talking about it, but believe me, I've gone through my share of anguish over this, and it gives me no pleasure to talk about it like this. But so that's the scenario of the film. And then, oh gosh, they try to, they go on a talk show, they're all naive, they've never done anything like that. They think they're going to tell the world and the world's going to listen and something's going to change. And of course, the talk show hosts are the usual, well, caricatures of the usual. Are they talk show hosts? Are they news anchors? I mean, can you tell the difference in some stations? Anyway, they're belittling it. They're trying to say, oh, you discovered a new comet, how great. And then they kind of, when they try to say that it's an apocalypse, they kind of, we don't want to hear about that. And anyway, you can imagine the scenario if you haven't seen it. If you have seen it, you know what I'm talking about. And then, they first get an audience with the president before they go on the media. And that didn't go well because the president, played by an extremely famous actress whose name escapes me for the moment. I'm sure he'll come back. But anyway, is more concerned about the Meryl Streep. Thank you, Ty. Is more concerned about the midterms and a scandal. I mean, there's just a lot of salacious, really kind of over-the-top elements, which, make it kind of enjoyable, because you have to, it's a heavy, heavy subject, so you got to kind of lighten it up. Anyway, she was having an affair with the man that she nominates for her Supreme Court position, and he was like a porn star or has acted in porn films. And anyway. Yeah, there's a lot. Throws a lot in there. But okay, so I could go on. I'm not going to go through the whole film. They don't get anywhere, and then the president changes their mind because they think that it might help their ratings, and because of the scandal. And then this, anyway, there's this buckaroo who's kind of like Slim Pickens in help me, Ty. What was that famous anti-nuclear film? Oh, Dr. Strangelove. There you go. How could I forget? There's a lot of comparisons that people are making to Dr. Strangelove. He goes up on this mission. They're going to make a robot mission to blow up this asteroid, which is a real thing. In fact, there's a planetary defense agency, there's a man who plays a role in the very beginning. He's kind of like a third protagonist, I guess, in the film. After the grad student Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio, the professor, and I can't remember his, not as quite as flamboyant a part, the actor's name. But anyway, he's the head of that agency, which actually exists, Planetary Defense, and they're tasked with actually identifying comets that might be celestial bodies, asteroids, comets that might be a threat to the Earth. And it's a real agency, and I wonder, how much are we paying as much attention to actually thwarting the more obvious and direct threat of climate change? But that's another sub. So anyway, it's a very, very involved plot, and it doesn't end well. Let's put it that way. But okay, so like I said, if you want to talk about January 6th and other, which is, that whole thread is, it just adds to the surreal nature of the moment we're in, that at the moment when a comet-like apocalyptic event is impending upon the Earth in the form of climate change, and it's just increasingly dire consequences, fires, floods, rain bombs, fire bombs, snow bombs. And at that moment, we need global coordination of a kind that we've never had. You know, we can't get it because, you know, we're fighting with China, we're fighting with Russia. The UN is pretty much dysfunctional because of the geopolitics. Our own politics are dismal, and it's just a bad situation all in all. Let's admit it. So there's a January 6th, and I'm talking about the film Don't Look Up. Okay, so what was my takeaway? I said that I was really kind of, I guess, aggravated by people who are just sort of approaching it, sort of this, just sort of critiquing an art form, a piece, you know, a film, rather than, you know, what I took it for was reality. So, you know, so it hit me hard. So I had to pause when I watch on Netflix, like, I can't tell you how many times, probably a couple dozen times, just because it really got to my gut. I couldn't, just the surreal nature of it. I mean, I've compared our situation regarding climate change to an episode of the Twilight Zone more than once on this program. And yeah, it really is. And in fact, the two protagonists, the professor and the PhD student, Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio, are, you know, early on, they're saying, from the very beginning almost, that they discover this, they're like, this can't be happening. Is this real? This can't be happening. They're just, you know, they're put in the position of being the ones. I guess, you could, obviously, climate scientists compare themselves to them. You know, of course, it's been decades and decades since we've known that, it's like over 100 years since we've known that CO2 buildup, just the science, the physics of it, creates this greenhouse effect and leads to global warming. We've known that for a long time. We've known the increasingly dire nature of the consequences, possible consequences, now real consequences, for decades. So yeah, that really struck me, that there. And then just the three-ring circus swirling around this thing, and the inability of people to, you know, to focus their minds in a coherent and effective way, you know, starting from the decision makers on down. And then you've got, you know, the MAGA sort of, you know, the president, Meryl Streep's character is, I guess, yeah, she's got to be Republican because she's got a portrait of Richard Nixon in the Oval Office. So I guess that's pretty obvious. Yeah, there were kind of some obvious partisan things that, you know, I don't know, probably in the end detract from it, because it's certainly not a partisan issue in terms of how it was caused. You know, the fossil fuel economy certainly predated both the Republicans and Democrats, but anyway, it's been fostered by in a bipartisan way, the corporate fossil fuel corporate dictatorship. Anyway, what was I saying about Meryl Streep? I was going to make some point. Anyway, 503-231-8187. I'm already a third through the program. I'd love to hear your impressions. Or as I say, if you really feel you want to talk about January 6th, you want to talk about two things together. So yeah, my takeaway was just that it really conveyed to me the existential threat, it could hit you in the gut. But then again, you already had to see it that way almost, you know, which is a flaw in the film. And I kind of want to read something from, I've been, like I said, reading so many reviews and things on Facebook. But what I liked was that it did hit you hard. But I'll read you this from a Facebook friend who, anyway, says, mostly I think, Mostly, I think the film preaches to the choir in the form of an inside joke metaphor. That's not to say that it hasn't made an impression on other folks, but for those who don't spend large amounts of time, their time organizing anti-capitalist spaces, moving from awareness to action, takes constant repetition and engagement. Excellent point. In that way, I think this film validates one camp that's already been yelling at the top of their lungs and feeling like Cassandras, while for the rest of the population, those who need to wake up, stay awake, and to activate to do something, anything, this film actually tells them not to bother, that it won't matter in the end. It's a lost cause, so they should just figure out where and how to spend whatever time there is left, just enjoying the small talk around the dinner table instead. That's kind of referring to the end of the film. Interesting point. I hadn't actually seen it that way. There's a lot to talk about there. But the film becomes a punchline rather than a call to action. But also, expecting any single work of fiction to contain all the elements necessary to raise those who sleep and move them to act is also magical thinking. There's so many good points here. The world needs a series, something that catches people's attention, then holds it, nurtures it, and instructs us all. And we already have that in a multiplicity of fragmented formats, but the folks that need it are tuned out and immersed in the constant sea of amusement. The film everyone needs to see right now around the world with as much hype is Network. Good old Network. We all collectively must metaphorically throw our televisions out the window and start getting mad as hell, then fight together like in the new Matrix movie. Sigh. That's a one perspective. Yeah, Jeff Gibbs' perspective, the maker of A Planet of the Humans, who, gosh, I really intend to have on this show someday, sees it as a kind of basically a diatribe against green technology. He's talking a lot about that, the illusion of green technology. Well, because there's a tech multi-billionaire who's sort of an amalgamation of Bezos, Zuckerman, Elon Musk. I heard maybe this guy, Alan Thiel, who is an immigrant from Switzerland or Germany or somewhere, another tech multi-billionaire, and also the head of that doomsday comet cult, whose name I can't remember, who apparently looks very much like the actor who plays this this multi-billionaire, who basically hijacks the plan to destroy the asteroid because it's been discovered to contain many valuable minerals, which is because basically what Jeff Gibbs and other people say, you know, and I largely agree, is that, you know, what we're doing now is we're, in order to supposedly substitute for the fossil fuel economy, we're embarking very haphazardly without really stopping any of the fossil fuel production. We're gearing up this whole, you know, ancillary additional layer of industrial production to produce, you know, electric cars and batteries and all this stuff, which requires whole new kinds of minerals like lithium, more copper, more of other things, cobalt, all of which, you know, require massive industrial intervention in natural ecosystems and in a lot of cases displacing indigenous peoples or impacting their traditional territories, like in northern Nevada, with the big lithium mine that's they're trying to get underway, and you know a lot of the minerals on that asteroid are the kind of minerals you would think of or this, you know, the so-called new economy or green economy or whatever. Anyway, we could even have a discussion, but it looks like we do have a caller. I haven't been checking out my Facebook to see who it is. Looks like Joe's on the line. Go ahead, Joe.
Good morning. I'm glad you finally were able to have a show about this, I think, important movie. And I appreciate how you were kind of segueing to what I would want to bring up, and bringing up the question of like technological solutions to climate change as they come across in that film. And I think it's interesting that there's kind of two films in the film. There's the first, not even half of the film, that leads up to a mission to go just straightforward, blow up the problem, get rid of it. And then, as you were saying, the billionaire character, who's an amalgamation of all of these tech billionaires and people who think that with their money they're going to evolve humanity or something like that, convinces the president that actually there's a business opportunity in allowing the crisis to unfold basically unchecked, hoping that technology in the 11th hour of a certain kind will manifest and not only make the problem go away, but make the problem into a lot of money. And I thought that maybe one of the weakest parts of the movie is how the president and the ruling class, I mean, this was written under Trump. It was long before even the pandemic fully bloomed that they had finished writing it. But in kind of making the ruling class and its sycophancy to the capitalist plans so partisan, it misses out on the like even more absurd bipartisan reality of these technological solutions in the climate change context, because to compare to the allowing the comet to come to Earth so that we can mine it and build a whole new world with the resources it provides, the real world corollary is what is being pushed at the COP, at the UN climate summit, and all such meetings of world leaders, and it's called BECCS. It's called Bioenergy and Carbon Capture. It is a plan that basically hinges on growing the economy, allowing it to continue unabated, and investing in the profits, because this is a profit machine we're talking about, into green technology or other mitigating factors for the climate crisis, including in the 11th hour again, technology that largely doesn't exist that will Deus ex machina suck the carbon out of the atmosphere. And that is being pushed by the Democrats right now. And I feel like there are good reasons why that story kind of focuses on a Trump-like character being written when it is, and we're still like living in the reality of another authoritarian right-winger taking power in the next few years. But at the same time, I feel like it might confuse people about like what the real solutions actually are to our comet that's hurtling to us, because the movie is about how the leaders try to sell the population on this. And that is exactly what's happening with a lot of, you can call it green tech solutions, or, you know, it's more of really allowing the fossil fuel economy to burn out its last eke in the hope that that's going to provide the capital, to provide the investment revenue to build something else and better. And I think that I was reading an interview with McKay that came out earlier in December when it was just like, I think, being released to people who would review the film and maybe initial theaters. Adam McKay said that when asked like what makes him optimistic, that he says, you know, there are things we can do. There's renewables, there's carbon capture technology. And it like blew me away that the guy who just made this film, that's
interesting,
securing that all, is also, you know, a human in this whole system and is liable to be bamboozled. I mean, I don't necessarily write him off for that, but just to say that if you can make this movie and say that, we obviously have to connect the dots a bit more.
That's interesting. Your ears are tuned to important things there. That really makes me think that. And your analysis, I agree, is spot on. Just one thing to throw out. In addition to the bioenergy and carbon capture, there's also, you know, the opening up of the Northern Sea Route and all the possible minerals and resources that everybody's now slobbering after. And, you know, who knows? You know, Greenland. You know, maybe what's under Antarctic. I mean, that's the level that's when you only see the world through commodities and profit, then you don't see it as a living, breathing organism. Then that's just the way it's going to go. That's interesting. I guess I'm at a bit of a loss because I have a lot of respect for McKay. I mean, I thought The Big Short and Vice were really two excellent, excellent films. So I was kind of predisposed to sort of respect his take. But as you say, you know, his consciousness is where it's at. And, you know, so basically what you're saying is, in some ways, I don't know if you're directly saying it or possibly implying it might be the case that he's, you know, the way the film plays out is a reflection, of his own limited understanding of what's going on, that he might actually come down on those kinds of solutions. It's kind of a mess though, you know. It's a mess in the way that, you know, I kind of see it as a mess. It's like, there's a plan, but it's really not a plan. I mean, if the kind of the there's a real kind of bitter darkness to the whole way that it ends up, as you see their plan to, okay, so what they're going to do is they're supposedly the counter plan by this multi-billionaire, whatever the name of his company is, like Bash or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway. I guess he was a big software developer, kind of like a. I guess you can also throw in Bill Gates there to the mix in terms of who the character is based on, but he's gonna blow it up into small pieces that are then all gonna rain into the Pacific Ocean, and then they're gonna recapture all these bits for all the minerals, and then it's kind of darkly funny actually if you know it's like first one of the I forget how many different vehicles. There's a bunch of different vehicles with different roles. One's going to drill in and put in the thing, and the others are going to guide the asteroids to the pieces of the comet to the Earth. And like one blows up on launch, and then another one blows up on the. Anyway, they lose a bunch of them until basically, and you know, initially DiCaprio actually confronts, oh God, we got two more callers. I'll stop talking. He confronts I should say his name, but I can't remember the billionaire, and says,
Peter,
you know,
Isherwell.
Yeah. He says, you know, is this based on, you know, is any of this science behind this peer reviewed? Is there anything backing this? He's like, oh, you know, he calls, are you just a businessman? He's like, and he gets his hackles all up. Oh, just a businessman. Anyway. So yeah, so basically what I'm saying is that it's like we, you know, there is no plan. We do not have a plan to confront the climate. You know, the Green New Deal is not a plan. We do not have, you know, you need a global coordinated, we could go on and talk about it, but there, and it, so in a way it's very similar to what's going on. It's like the,
and yeah,
the,
well, I mean, I know you have two callers, and I'm just going to like cap off the conversation and saying that in the movie, they like point out that we do have the capacity to just deal with things. And that's represented in the fact that they come up with this straightforward classic disaster, asteroid disaster film plan to go blow it up, get rid of it. And what we have what's replaced in terms of our capacity as a society with technological power and collective capacities is this non-plan that the billionaires, the capitalists, you know, want us to go through. And unlike Jeff Gibbs, who is much more kind of like in anti-technology about this and like says basically that the whole framing of like having to stop a comet already makes a climate conversation unduly focused on technology. Like, if we're going to radically degrow the economy and not go into resource wars, of course we're going to have to use technology in innovative and advanced ways to communize and collectivize like our ways of life to reduce demands on the earth. And that capacity is what, you know, socialists have also been saying for hundreds of years now about like, look, we have the ability to feed the world, to provide for everyone's needs, and I don't want us to lose sight of that. And that's what I think the film is putting into perspective, is that we could be dealing with this, but we're going down these rabbit holes that the capitalists suck us into.
Okay, well, thanks, Joe. Of course, that's a big topic. You know, is there a plan that's adequate to the task? Good question. Okay, let's go to Harry. You're next up. Sorry to wait so long.
Greetings, and thank you for taking my call. One of the websites I go to for information is Counterpunch. And if you went there this weekend, and they also have they have a button for Counterpunch radio. And Jacqueline was on it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. So everyone should check it out. And of course, she's doing the, you mentioned January 6th tomorrow at 10, so I will be listening to it. So what I'd like to talk about is January 6th. One of the main things I remember about it is the speech that Trump was giving. Quite a few people got speech. He gave speeches. And one of them was Giuliani. And what did he say? Trial by combat. That means it's going to be a riot. They should have known right then and there. You know, he should be also, hopefully they will subpoena him, even though he's Trump's attorney, for the January 6th Select Committee, you know.
Indeed.
So yeah, and it's still going on. I'm glad they decided to have the Select Committee. It's going to go on probably for another year or so, because there's just so much information. And I'm glad it's being done. So anyway, your opinion on January 6th?
Well, it's interesting. I was listening to Chris Hedges, who kind of denies that it was actually a coup, because he's actually lived through. I heard him on alternative radio yesterday on KBOO at 9 o'clock on Tuesday mornings. A great old show, still going strong. But anyway, yeah, he was saying that he doesn't think it's a coup because, you know, he's lived through real coups. But I mean, it doesn't, you know, that's not that important. He's, you know. But I think it was interesting because, and he's also talks about there's legislation that apparently, I was going to look this up, I haven't, I don't know if anybody out there knows about this, that would class socialists as terrorists. It seems a little too simplistic, but there's some new anti-terrorism legislation coming out of January 6th. So yeah, he's playing sort of the counter voice on these things, I think it was it a classic coup attempt in terms of like the army general, who has the loyalty of a large section of the army and other elements in the society making the move, you know. Usually in societies that have somewhat less robust, you know, so-called democratic institutions than we do, but, you know, they're being tested sorely here. So yeah, it wasn't that kind of coup, but I think the Republican representatives and senators who thought they might be able to overturn it during the counting electoral votes, you know, is
And they tried everything.
They tried everything. And the people who stormed the Capitol, I think they sincerely thought that they were actually going to impact it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was a, you know, whether it was an insurrection, whether it was a coup attempt, whatever, I think it definitely were trying to keep Trump in power. And, yeah, it's interesting. I think it'll be really interesting how it plays out, how the various legal cases against Trump are playing out in New York and elsewhere. The civil suits by those might be the sleeper cases. There's one by a Capitol policeman. I don't know if it includes Trump, but those might really bring out some information. I think they're getting hit by all sides. I think it's right. There's a guy on CNN last night who said that they're talking about, you know, what did it mean that Trump canceled his press conference? It was scheduled for tomorrow. One guy was saying he thinks he's actually getting worried that they're actually getting closer through, you know, the lawsuit, the investigation into the family businesses, the lawsuits, the select committee, the Justice Department, whatever they're doing, which we know certainly a lot less about. And, you know, these civil suits, I think I don't know, is he gonna escape, as he seems to have escaped from just about every other, you know, major repercussion for his bankruptcies and sordid behavior through his life? We'll see.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, thank you for taking my call.
All right. Well, I've been going on and on. I've got another caller. It looks like David's up next. Go ahead. You're on the air. You're still with us?
Yeah. Yes, Paul. Yes, I've worked in the forest around here in the past for several years, and a lot of the big companies and the forest practices here are done what's called plantations. And when this type is done, it actually leaves a lot more fuel and stuff in the forest. It destroys the biodiversity. Now, they can log and do things and leave more of an overstory and stuff and leave stuff and not be as dangerous. I think some of this happens because we get focused on climate change, which is kind of out there, but the forests are right around us here. And this plantation thing, they put the logging companies spend big money to have advertisements on TV saying, oh no, we're doing a great job, don't worry, you know, we leave a few areas, you know, and that's one issue. And another one is GMOs and Roundup. It is quite a problem, and it seems to be now kind of overlooked. And I just wanted to bring them up because, like I said, I think a lot of attention is directed towards climate change, which is very devastating. But
it's not just very devastating. It threatens to end a large, whatever the word is, mammalian life and perhaps other life on planet Earth in a relatively short position. But yeah, I mean, but it all relates, you know, the Monsanto and Roundup is just caused devastation of insect and other species, and
yeah.
And the forests, one of the most important things to have some kind of buffer against climate change is to have intact ecosystems, especially older, mature forests, which absorb much more carbon. It's been known for quite a while now, and yet, you know, they're able to use all sorts of excuses, including these fires that happen, to go in and cut, you know, green trees and old trees. And yeah, the forest industry has been lying through their teeth. Well, first they didn't really have any scientific, you know, counter arguments, but since they've had those scientific counterarguments for the past 30, 40 years, they've just been lying through their teeth and trying to continue the same practices under different names. Yeah, you're totally right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That was our last caller, and we've still got 10 minutes to go. 503-231-8187. Yeah, no, I'm really still thinking about what Joe had to say. I mean, the whole issue of technology and response to climate change, you know, I had, my mind is just blanking today, but a climate scientist I had on my show several times a few years ago and was talking about the three-legged stool of response to climate change. Stop, you know, fossil fuel extraction, the extraction and burning of fossil fuels, slow it down, stop it. Then some kind of carbon sequestration, which is, you know, they're just experimenting with these artificial trees now, which, you know, you'd say, well, why don't they just stop logging the forest? Well, yeah, I mean, if we could had the ability to make that stick completely, especially in places like the Amazon and Siberia and other big carbon sinks. And the other one is actually some kind of geoengineering. And he was, you know, a climate scientist who believed that we were so far along the course that it's happening so fast that we really won't be able to, collective responses that, you know, we might have thought, you know, 20, 30 years ago are no longer adequate. I don't, you know, these are important questions, and we really get back to the time, and I keep saying this over and over again. How much time do we really have? That actually has a lot to do with our ability or inability or, you know, the kind of response that we'll have to climate change. So a lot of people don't really want to talk about that. They think, oh, we don't really know, whatever. I think there's an urgency to this that is so far beyond almost everybody's ability to really handle, to grasp, and deal with it. It's a big handicap. But looks like we got a couple more callers. All of a sudden, let's go to Mitch. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to bring the conversation back to the community some of us live in who are under the economic uncertainties of the precariat, which long predates the pandemic breaking out. And no one is covering or talking about the fires that wiped out a big commercial part of downtown Hillsboro.
I heard about that.
And your program is followed by Washington County News, which always paints such a rosy picture about business leading us out of the darkness. And I just wanted to see if there's anybody at KABU that's interested in drawing the comparison between how the pandemic has called attention to the broader economic failures of our policymakers, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and how who is bearing the brunt of the downtown Hillsboro fires, by the way, are small, single proprietary businesses, you know, it just seems to me that nobody is calling attention to the fact that a lot of the pandemic seems to have been directing greater public resources to private wealth. I know that that's been the subtext of some of the Chomsky talks that he's given to both Laura Flanders and
Amy Goodman.
And Amy Goodman, yeah. His focus is incredible, given he's 93. If he were, you know, 23, it would be just as impressive.
He looks more and more like a gnome, but he's...
But he's helping us focus on what needs to be focused on, because we don't have a media that allows the sorts of conversations that could point to the wider spread economic policy failures all around us. And I don't think talking about Hollywood movies where we're all out of our scientific depths is helping us focus on that. The reason I bring it up is because when I look at the coverage in the Pamplin papers or even in Willamette Week, much less, you know, the Democratic Socialists of America online, I don't see anybody drawing comparisons with what happened in the Bronx during the firebug era of my youth, where small businesses that couldn't survive the economic collapse of New York in the 80s were going in and burning down what was left of tenement housing to collect on the insurance.
You're not saying there's anything like that behind the Hillsborough fire, are you?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm someone who walked through Hillsborough even before pandemic and saw the economic collapse of every attempt that the Washington County had to stimulate some kind of growth there after the condo building boom of downtown Hillsborough busted, and all those properties that they built as luxury condos had to be leased out because no one was earning enough money to buy luxury condos. And now they can't pay even enough monthly rents on the leases. So if you look at the work of Aaron Glantz in Home Wreckers, and he's now teaching at Stanford after a career in nonprofit investigative journalists, this is what he was pointing out, is that the real feudal lords we have to be aware of are on Wall Street, and they're not, Dr. Strangelove types of characters.
I don't want to counterpose what you're talking about, which, as you know, I used to cover a lot more when I had a couple different co-hosts who talked about this sort of thing, and that's probably a lack, and so I appreciate you bringing that up. But I don't want to, say that they're, one is valid and the other isn't valid, because climate change.
I also want to talk about the misattribution of global climate conditions to what happened in Boulder, Colorado, because you were rightfully thanking David Barsamian for continuing with alternative radio, even though so many NPR affiliates dropped that program over the last decade. It seems to me that that fire, and I only noticed this by stopping for pizza at Escape from New York yesterday, and the New York Times was on the counter, and seeing that what they're finding is that flash fire before the snows came, and they still don't know how many humans died in that flash fire about the same time Hillsborough happened, had very human suspicions around it, because
right, but happened, that's just the spark.
It happened on the property of a new cult.
Well, no. There's a lot more to that we can't get into, and we have a couple other callers we probably can't get into. But that's okay. I just want to just push back and say, no, the conditions. There's a spark, and then there's the conditions that allow the spark to create a conflagration. And we're talking about historic drought in the West, and we're talking about 100 plus mile an hour winds, which probably have to do with the changing patterns of the jet stream, which has to do with the rapid warming up of the Arctic. These strangely not strange anymore events have to do with the incredible energy being put into the system by the rapid warming of the climate. But anyway, we got to go, Mitch.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Okay.
I think it's bringing clarity.
Let's go one more caller. Your quick point, and then we got to go. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, is that me?
Yep.
Hi, Paul.
Oh, Barry, I'm sorry. We really have 20 seconds, and I think you're going to probably...
Okay, the 36 people that were homeless that died over the winter, I wanted to mention that.
Okay. Thank you.
And just we've got to keep give shelter to our own people.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, Barry, and... unfortunately, they probably won't be the last, I hate to say it, as we are really just getting into the winter. Okay. Wow, that's a tough note to end on there. Sorry to Thomas and whoever else I might have missed. Thank you for the people who called. Thank you for listening. Thank you, everybody, who supported us in our recent end-of-the-year membership drive and made it successful. Yay! So we can keep doing these shows and all the other great programming here on KBOO FM here in Portland. I'm Paul Rowland, signing off for Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you, Ty, for operating the board. Bye, everybody.
The center cannot hold. This is somebody else's dream. out of the nighttime.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up, we have Fight the Empire.
Is that reel from this blow to the heart? Turn to each other on the night of the supermoon. There was nowhere left to run. Now it's time to do or die.
Well, good morning. My name is Per Fogring, and the show is Fight the Empire, first show of our